US rule in occupied earth, or everything you need to know about genocide but never knew to ask. Part 2, Days of Revolt. Now, to explain the title, it is actually a reference to a work by Chris Hedges and Joe Sacco entitled Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. But I didn't know that Chris Hedges was going to be starting a TV series called Days of Revolt when I came up with the title. And of course, I recorded the part one, so I was committed to that title earlier anyway. But he has actually started a TV series called Days of Revolt, and it's on Telesur English, and well worth checking out. You can find it on their website. Anyway, I ended part one by castigating those who seek justice and redress from authorities like the ICC. This is not an era in which forward progress can be made through existing institutions. I'm not against meaningful reform, but working towards it has now become a form of rearguard action in a war that people are losing. Those who wield power in Western societies have become far too good at wielding power. They are not meaningfully opposed or moderated, and that means that they will continue down a path of social destruction even at their own expense. Now, if it makes it easier to swallow, the point I'm making is actually closely linked to a point made that Chris Hedges has been emphasising in the last few years, hence the title. Actually, it's more than one point, really, because Hedges is promoting revolt, and he is saying that this is an age that needs rebels, true dissidents. He is fond of citing Václav Havel and sentiments that Havel conveyed, such as this, quote, "The dissident does not operate in the realm of genuine power at all. He is not seeking power. He has no desire for office and does not gather votes. He does not attempt to charm the public. He offers nothing and promises nothing. He can offer, if anything, only his skin, and he offers it solely because he has no other way of affirming the truth he stands for. His actions simply articulate his dignity as a citizen, regardless of the cost." End quote. This, of course, resonates with the earlier quote from Dr. Tiranagama that I cited in part one, quote, "Objectivity, the pursuit of truth, and critical, honest positions is crucial for the community, but it is a view that could cost many of us our lives." End quote. Neither sentiment leaves room for sugarcoating the truth or leaving out parts of the truth on the grounds that they are confrontational or may alienate potential allies. Moreover, they do not allow one to decide that others do not have the intellectual capacity to grasp the whole truth and must be spoon-fed half-truths and white lies calculated to bring about the cause that you think is righteous, to bring support to the cause that you think is righteous. The other key thing about real dissidents is that they don't think that they can convince the powerful of the error of their ways. It's actually quite disturbing that the voices we hear criticising power are dominated by a privileged tone that projects shared interests and innate benevolence onto people such as Clinton, Obama, or Kerry. Whether people overtly state this belief or not, it is inherent in any discussion that suggests that if the powerful could only be brought to see things from our perspective, they would end their harmful practices. This is the equivalent of an Auschwitz inmate trying to persuade a guard that the Nuremberg laws were both immoral and against the interests of Germany. The guard is unlikely to want to hear what you are saying, but if you do manage to persuade them, where does that leave you or him? It is also a type of fallacy. To assume our leaders act with the best intentions is generally treated as being more conservative and intellectually credible than to suggest otherwise. In fact, to do so is to impute motive. That is a fallacy. It is a bankrupt practice, and it is automatically applied selectively in such a way that the enemy regimes are assumed to act with ill intent, whilst our leaders are presumed to mean well, at least for their own countries, if not for humanity as a whole. The most common argument used to deny that the US has committed genocide is that there was no intention to commit genocide because US leaders have no such intent. Those who use such arguments do not look for evidence of intentionality any more than they would look for evidence of unicorns, because they already know that the evidence doesn't exist. If you confront them with the fact that there is, say, more evidence of US intent to commit genocide in Cambodia than there is of Khmer Rouge intent to commit genocide, they will be upset because they know that the words and acts that seem to indicate US intentionality are misrepresentations of the actual inner processes of US officials. But the words and acts that suggest Khmer Rouge intentionality are revelations of their true inner nature. In the final analysis, though, whether our leaders are monstrous psychopaths or normal people trapped within a monstrous system is irrelevant. In fact, it's a false dichotomy between agential individuals and mere cogs. Whether or not one considers Western leaders to be demonically evil, they must accommodate to the degree to which the regimes in which they function are diseased and criminal. For example, a President of the United States, a US Secretary of Defense, and a US Secretary of State must all commit war crimes in order to function within a system that requires it of them. The same can be said of the UK Prime Minister, Foreign Minister, and Minister of Defense. Even should someone in that position have a change of heart, like Robert McNamara did, they could never be trusted to set things right because they cannot help but live in denial. Their involvement and their complicity is too profound. Likewise, as Chris Hedges points out, there is no longer any point in putting faith in individuals or groups to work to reform the regime within its power structure. In a recent talk with Truthdig editor Robert Shear, Hedges specifically references Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and says, quote, "We've got to stop placing our faith in particular individuals. That is just not how power responds. Power responds when it feels threatened, end quote. Hedges points out that working within the system is not an avenue to change, and closing it may seem negative, but it is actually a source of hope. It is unfortunate that it takes severe crisis and dysfunction to bring this point about, but it is only once people stop placing faith in fantasies that they can act in their own interests. We have seen in the US that faith placed in Barack Obama was taken as unconditional because there were no electoral alternatives for people who aren't hateful or stupid. Depending on your viewpoint, this has either freed or forced Obama into being a tool of elite vested interest, while making enough rhetorical obeisance to public will to keep the shabby and translucent facade of democracy from collapsing into a pile of dust. That is why, paradoxically, our political elites would act with more humanity if we treated them as being baby-eating reptilian invaders from outer space, because then they would feel constrained not to act like baby-eating reptilian invaders from outer space. Just as we cannot elevate heroes to effect transformation, it is also true that we cannot transform by debasing villains. Modern states, with their inquiries and commissions and committee investigations, have developed a huge amount of expertise in channeling justified outrage into ever-decreasing spirals of ever-narrower objection. These processes end with the anticlimax of a drivelling pseudo-apology. We're sorry because we tried to bring too much freedom to the world, and we messed up because we're too damn democratic, and our vicious free press stabbed us in the back. This model resembles the appalling Frost-Nixon interviews, where David Frost went out of his way to systematically absolve Nixon of every one of his truly momentous crimes. But every porn production must have its cum shot, and after hours of this fellatio, Nixon ejaculates, "I let the American people down." And what a powerful confession that was. It's a little bit like John Wayne Gacy apologizing for bringing disrepute to the amateur clown fraternity, as if that was his only crime. "I let the clowns of this great land of America down." In this vein, when modern Western states do take actions against their own personnel, they follow these rules. 1. Unless there is an inconvenient senior officer who could do with being taken down a peg, such as Janice Karpinski, ensure that you choose as few people as possible from as low in the hierarchy as possible. 2. Decontextualize and minimize the crimes. Maintain above all that they are aberrant, isolated acts not linked to anything broader. Their isolation shows that they are an exception that proves the rule of our fundamentally benevolent nature. 3. Portray the accused as victims of the brutality generated by the savagery of their victim society. 4. Give as lenient a judgment as humanly possible. 5. Reverse the judgment with a pardon or reduction in sentence as soon as humanly possible. 6. Milk the proceedings as much as possible to provide proof that yours is a society of laws, whilst tacitly or explicitly reiterating that the genesis of the crimes lay in the unwanted contact with the unlawful and brutal society of the victims. This, of course, is the trope that was expounded most famously by Joseph Conrad in Heart of Darkness, where the contact with deepest, darkest Africa polluted the white person and turned him into a savage. And that was reiterated in Apocalypse Now, which was based on that story. This is how it works with criminal proceedings, but of course there are also committees of inquiry or select committee processes and that sort of thing. And the way they work, these inquiries, is that you establish terms of reference which exclude to whatever extent possible anything that is truly important. And then you create a false critique on that basis, and then you try to get your opposition or the opponents of your crimes to commit to that false critique. And I think we're probably seeing the unfolding of a masterstroke of this form with the Chilcot inquiry, because they are making people beg for it to be released, and then of course it will be released, and it will turn out to be a complete whitewash. And then these people, long after people's memories have faded, will have to be the opponents of the war crimes in Iraq, will have to go back and try and explain from the beginning why this is in fact an inadequate and propagandistic exercise, when they have spent considerable time themselves calling for this inquiry, the findings of the inquiry, to be released. But to return to the will they, won't they shell game of criminal proceedings, Israel has this procedure down to a fine art. And like all truly brilliant acts of public diplomacy, this practice exerts a disciplinary influence on both supporters and opponents of Israel's foreign policy at home and abroad. Israel can keep Palestinian human rights activists running on a treadmill that they can't justify leaving, because there's always hope that a judicial process will provide some small relief from the greater tides of injustice. Of course, it is some time since Israeli courts have really done anything significant to constrain the Israeli occupation forces, which of course includes the courts themselves, as they are part of the occupation. And they barely do anything to constrain Israeli settlers either. But there is also a broader problem that is encouraged by Israel and or the ICC dangling the prospect of criminal convictions, in that it helps obscure the systematic criminality of the occupation. The recent news of the death of 18-month-old Ali Dawabsha has highlighted what Ali Abunima describes as a, quote, hypocritical display of crocodile tears, end quote. By unreserved condemnation of the singular act, Israel's leaders quite clearly intend to create a false image that acts to obscure the greater systemic violence. The problem is not just that Zionists use this technique, but that anti-Zionists end up being drawn into doing exactly the same thing in slightly different circumstances. So what I'm talking about here is this miscontextualizing things by taking the individual and using that to obscure the greater systemic problems. So, for example, Charlotte Silver of the Electronic Intifada has reported that an Israeli, Lieutenant Colonel Neria Yeshurun, was recorded ordering the shelling of a medical facility. Of course, you have to report when such evidence comes to light, but this tends to become what I would term overproving. Not only did we already have eyewitness reports from Palestinians and international observers of such crimes, but Israeli personnel had already confessed such actions to breaking the silence. As it stands, it is good that supporters of Palestinian human rights can point to this recording as being symptomatic because it shows that few Israelis consider it wrong to commit war crimes. On the other hand, if the focus becomes pursuing the punishment of Yeshurun, and I'm not saying it will, but just imagine that it did, on the grounds that he is a blatant war criminal and the prima facie evidence is impossible to ignore, then you get into really quite bad territory for the cause of Palestine. And I know this might seem counterintuitive. When you've got an obvious criminal there, and I'm saying don't try to pursue that criminal because that's counterproductive. But every erg of human energy that activists put into trying to get Yeshurun punished will be worse than a waste. Focusing on one criminal risks entering an endless spiral of diminishing convolution. It will produce a discourse that combines screeching to the converted with a naive belief that you can somehow shame your enemies into admitting that they're actually the bad guys. That is not going to happen. Israelis aren't going to go, oh yes, we're the new Nazis. At the same time, every bit of focus on Yeshurun's blatant crime will devalue the clear testimony of Israeli whistleblowers and of international observers, and above all, the voices of Palestinian victims themselves. Perhaps even worse, it would devalue the shared consensus experience. The media coverage of Operation Protective Edge in many countries was sufficient for most people to see that the narrative construction of a conflict is a farce. Despite the unusual number of Israeli casualties during that operation, what people saw on their screens and felt in their guts was a one-sided slaughter. Yet that comprehension is being eroded by continuous miscontextualization, and the focus on individual crimes only furthers the diminishment of that greater truth. And the odd thing is that the gut response of the uneducated layperson is a more sound legal opinion than the mediated, educated responses of the mealy-mouthed weasels who function as international jurists. As long as Israel maintains its occupation and or blockade of Gaza, they cannot justify their actions under Article 51 of the UN Charter as being self-defence. And if it's not self-defence, then the use of armed force is illegal in all circumstances under the UN Charter. That is true even if Gazan militants commit war crimes. That means that every single Palestinian killed by Israel outside of Israel's borders, whether they're an armed militant or not, has been murdered. And quite possibly, even if those Israeli militants have invaded Israel and they're on Israeli territory when they're murdered, it still could be argued that they... when they're killed, I mean, it still could be argued that they're murdered because they are legitimately exercising their right to self-defense. This all means that by selecting certain individuals and prosecuting them, you are inevitably suggesting that murder is legitimate if it is carried out in a certain manner, but not legitimate if it is committed while breaking other rules. You see, you can see why I think that this is problematic. I'm concentrating on the practical political realities here. I mean, if you basically take one lieutenant colonel who happened to record himself saying, hey chaps, let's go out there and commit a war crime, you're just telling the Israeli commanders, make sure you don't commit, record yourself when you're going to commit war crimes. But even in sentimental terms, what does it mean to go after Yeshurun? What does it mean for the memories of those children murdered at the behest of the Israeli officers and politicians who were careful enough not to be recorded ordering personnel to commit obvious war crimes? Where is their justice? Are they supposed to take satisfaction from symbolically from Yeshurun as representative of all the others? The mass murders committed by Israel are also part of a larger process of genocide. As with the tunnels, a slow process of genocide will sometimes incline the perpetrators to commit acts of acute mass violence to weaken resistance to ongoing low-grade state violence and structural violence. Some Israelis, with a kind of schizophrenic and unnerving honesty, refer to this as mowing the lawn. There are distinct genocidal similarities between Israel's occupation of Palestine, Sri Lankan occupation policies, and US interventions in a number of countries both currently and in the past. However, the real reason I bring up Israel here is the issue of the ICC, which bears further attention still. Now, earlier on my blog, I posted quite a lengthy condemnation of the ICC, which is also a condemnation of those who are promoting an ICC investigation into Israel's most recent crimes. I really can't summarize the thousands of words I wrote on the issue of the ICC in Israel here, but one key relevant point is this. The Rome Statute, the treaty which forms the basis of the ICC, states, quote, "A case is inadmissible where the case is being investigated or prosecuted by a state which has jurisdiction over it, unless the state is unwilling or unable genuinely to carry out the investigation or prosecution," end quote. Immediately, this places jurisdictional decisions in the realms of political judgment, which inevitably favours the powerful over the weak. It is worth considering what that actually means in effect. It means that the facts will exert one sort of influence in the form of a discourse of ideas and information, and it means that vested power will exert influence by shaping that discourse. If we view such a process as a contest between power and truth, the first thing we have to take into account is the impact of so-called soft power on perception. This is used to ensure that public perception of truth is muddled, uncertain, and contested. When the powerful commit mass violence, soft power is used to minimize the perception of suffering caused, but the more crucial task is to conceal intentionality. Once the manipulation of perception creates the widest possible room for debate in public, and let's face it, this is what happens. All of these major states, the war criminal states, spend a lot of time and money on propagandizing people in order to create disagreement. And so even if it's just splitting up public opinion rather than dominating public opinion, that's still a victory for them. Once they've done that, in private, behind closed doors, the hard power and the covert power are used to bribe, threaten, blackmail, subvert, and co-opt both individual persons and institutions up to and including entire countries, right? Thereafter, the powerful can be sure that individuals will take the least action possible. I'm talking here about people like ICC officials, which is likely to be no action at all. If you think about that escape clause they have there in the Rome Statute, where they only exercise jurisdiction if a state is unwilling or unable to carry out their own investigation, right? So, if a country like Sri Lanka or Israel wants to ensure that that nothing happens, they can choose to pursue their own prosecutions using the six rules I outlined above of minimising and miscontextualising and so forth, which will then enable the ICC or the officials from the ICC to claim that the perpetrator country is rightfully exercising jurisdiction. Naturally, this will be lapped up by journalists and bureaucrats who like who dearly love the perfection of what to them is the best of all possible worlds, the world we live in, our lovely liberal democratic world. They will then convey this into the public, who will be split between the reassured and the nonplussed, whilst independent observers will rage ineffectually about the fact that we're drowning in our own smugness. I know that many people on reading this or hearing me say this might think that this is all an extremist opinion on tactics, and there are other equally valid opinions, and that we can pursue these are useful avenues and we can pursue it, and I'm just being a naysayer. To them, my opinion is likely to seem like an expression of anti-authoritarianism or spiteful envy or whatever. But it is not a matter of opinion at all. Their historical record is so clear that the only way one could advocate ICC involvement is through willful ignorance, both of the ICC's record and the entire history of prosecutions for war crimes and crimes against humanity. Equally, to hold that an elite international judicial body will dispense justice that is not desirable to the US and European imperial interests is almost laughably intellectually lazy. It's not a secret that rising within the hierarchies of international bodies is a highly political process, combining both elements of diplomatic horse trading for some positions with the need for high ambition and the requirement that the personnel be the discreet and disciplined insider type that believes in working within the system and not going outside and blowing the whistle. No one in their right mind should think that the selective processes and the situational factors which constrain the behaviour of personnel at the court, the ICC, would ever allow them to become worthy of any level of our trust. In fact, they're worthy of contempt and condemnation, because whatever their self-righteous pretensions of being spreaders of justice, they profit in material terms and gain very high social status by taking a key role in a monstrous imperial project that has visited mass violence and immiseration through structural violence on hundreds of millions of people. It is vital that that national and international functionaries be forced to confront the injustices that they perpetrate. That is the most important fight in the world today, and part of that fight is the fight to expose the suffering brought about and the fight to humanise victims. The other part, however, is the fight over contextualisation. Contextualization is the most crucial issue. It is important to a degree that cannot be overstated, because miscontextualized human suffering becomes the fuel for ever more massive crimes of mass violence, such as aggression and genocide. Now, I think you can see where I'm going with this, but I just want to stop and, as an aside, say that key NGO people and the largest NGOs, of course, are equally as guilty of being imperialists and benefiting materially and socially from doing so, whilst still being able to claim that they're acting on the side of the angels as the bureaucrats. So bear that in mind as well. Anyway, every atrocity that happens in the world today is being interpreted according to an updated version of the ancient chauvinistic binary categorization of civilization and barbarity. We are civilized, which means that when barbarians kill other barbarians, we must kill barbarians to save barbarians from their own barbarity. When we kill barbarians, our intent, if not our actions, must be civilized, because we are civilized. It can be true of any self-identified group, but it is most acute and most stoutly defended amongst Westerners who have deep reserves of chauvinism and a sense of exceptionalism that is almost impenetrable. There are so many ideological components to Western chauvinism that it is hard to portray the entire phenomenon accurately. I propose here that we think of it in terms of being a complicated, schizophrenic, and contradictory form of white racism. I am, of course, acutely aware that African Americans, for example, can expound this racism, and no one should downplay the fact that Barack Obama embodies this racism. Nevertheless, the concept of an entity called the West arose at the same time as the concept that there were people who were in some manner white. And this, in practical terms, means that the two are inextricable, because no matter how precise our concept of what white people are, and no matter how expansive our notion of what the West is, there will always be a hegemonically white culture. Because Western Europe experienced a technologically and culturally driven explosion of imperialism that saw them impose domination on people who were on average generally darker, and sometimes quite pronouncedly so, such as in sub-Saharan Africa or Australia, an idea of whiteness came about, even though, of course, in reality, it's very arbitrary in terms of actual pigmentation. So Western chauvinism came to combine ideas of all sorts of things: progress, capitalism, Christianity, atheism, liberalism, democracy, freedom, humanism, and humanitarianism, among others. But I choose to emphasize racism because it's very easy to see, because it's literally constructed as a matter of black and white. For that reason, it becomes possible to see that whenever we essentialize any notion about the West, such as the idea that it has liberal democratic norms, it's actually a dog whistle racial reference, right? To put it in simple terms, Eurocentrism and US exceptionalism are expressions of white supremacy. Inescapably, they are expressions of white supremacy. That means that they inherently propound the inferiority of non-white people. If we claim that the West embodies values or so-called norms of, say, democracy, we are of necessity saying the inverse of the non-Western world. Not only does this require a completely distorted reading of history, but it is inevitably racist. Because the concept of the West cannot be disentangled from a concept of whiteness, the implications of making such statements are to reinforce notions that white people are civilized and non-white people are barbaric. You cannot get away with that. So when Barack Obama says these things, he is being a white supremacist. I know that might seem extreme, but it's true. Moreover, because the need to selectively overlook the atrocious violence of Western imperialism, Western chauvinism, or Eurocentrism is inescapably a form of racism which fuels double standards. So because we keep wanting to frame our own participation or our collective, or the West's collective role in history as being civilized, nice, and democratic and liberal, it fuels doublethink and cognitive dissonance. And it fuels the vicious, contradictory fanaticism of the white-hatted mass murderer of indigenous peoples, whose only explanation for such brutality is that he must have caught it like a contagion from the unnatural contact with the savage peoples. That trope that I was talking about that came from Joseph Conrad, or maybe didn't come from, was expressed by Joseph Conrad. Anyway, thus Westerners construct an ideology in which they themselves are the victims of their own acts of mass murder. So the struggle must be undertaken, therefore, to counter this massive agglomeration of ideology with the following understanding: the savagery is in the act, not the actor. Yet at every level in society, since the invention of agriculture at least, the powerful have always tried to ensure that they are not judged by their deeds, but rather by the good intentions that they assure others that they have. From the boss of a small business to the ruler of an empire, we are enjoined to see things from their perspective and to accept a priori their fundamentally benevolent motives. Well, that's the end of part 2, and this will be continued in part 3. Lemkin's logic.